Hello, everyone. This is your Captain Wade speaking, and I'm joined today by my executive officer and the man with all the brilliant plans, Will.
Welcome back, everybody.
Well, it's good to be back in the dry dock. I know I've had fun recently. My school hosted an Oktoberfest just last night, and I'm still recovering, but like any good sailor, I'm pushing through. As I recall, Will, we're back in the same time zone.
We are. So I just did a cross-country road trip, got to see lots of fun national parks and everything. So it's been a nice time.
And for the record, guys, he's named his car after a horse.
I have from the Roy Rogers show. It's kind of a throwback. So,
I thought it
yeah.
was Gunsmoke for some reason, but anyway, excellent. Well, folks, I can tell you that this is going to be an episode that we actually thought was so important that we're recording it out of our planned order of episode. Will, what are we talking about?
So today we're going to be talking about what I refer to as resistance navies. And these are the navies of various countries that were conquered by the Axis powers during World War II, but their ships went on to fight for the Allies, usually under their own flags. There were several cases where even if the country itself surrendered, the navy would go on fighting, for the good guys, so to speak. And so some of these are really inspiring stories that we don't hear a whole lot about. And some of these ships were actually involved in some pretty major battles, but the glory usually goes to the main Allied navies. So we thought we would take today to highlight some of the contributions of these forces to the Allied war effort.
Yeah, just so everyone is clear, when we're talking about resistance navies, one of the major standouts that we're talking about is the French, the Polish, the Dutch, and also to an extent, the Greek navy as well. We'll be getting back to that as well. But I can't emphasize enough the bravery of these Allied navies in exile. Whether it be the French navy or the Polish or the Dutch or any others, these brave sailors gave up their homeland. And very possibly sailed into an unknown sea to hopefully fight for a just cause another day. Everyone loves an underdog, right?
Exactly. And most of these people probably weren't sure if they would ever see their homeland again or if they were even going to win, but they did it anyway. So hats off to them.
Yes. So the funny thing, and I was looking through this, for my upcoming ship of the week, but the Dutch Navy actually had some of its greatest victories during the darkest days of the Second World War, just at the time when the Japanese were, I would say, rolling up the Dutch East Indies. And when I talk about the Dutch East Indies, we're talking about Southeast Asia, we're talking about Indonesia, we're talking about Malaysia, we're talking about these countries. The Dutch had colonies there, but unfortunately were steamrolled by the Japanese war effort. And I gotta say, there was a particular admiral of the Dutch Navy known as Admiral Heifrick, and his nickname was Ship-a-Day Helfrich. Helfrich, yeah, that, sorry, I pronounced it wrong the first time. Ship-a-Day Helfrich. He was actually almost literally sinking at least one ship a day in the Dutch East Indies, either Japanese or German forces. So he was considered a very, very aggressive general. In fact, the Allied forces actually pulled him off command because he was considered too aggressive for what they needed at the time.
And to put things in perspective a little bit, so when the Netherlands itself fell to Nazi Germany, that did not mean that was what was termed the Kingdom of the Netherlands was gone. And that also encompassed Aruba and Curaçao in the Caribbean, which ended up supplying a large amount of oil to the Allied war effort. And then what Wade mentioned, the Dutch East Indies. But to put things in perspective of the relative sizes of the forces involved, the Dutch Navy put up one heck of a fight for the East Indies, considering what they were up against. The main Dutch units in the area were only three light cruisers, the Tromp, the Java, and the De Ruyter. And they were up against basically the entire Imperial Japanese Navy, which, as we know, included battleships, aircraft carriers, dozens of cruisers. And against these odds, they put up a tremendous fight. Although it wasn't ultimately successful to save the Dutch East Indies, they certainly slowed them down.
And then the Dutch actually had another pretty interesting bit of military history attached to them. During operations in the Mediterranean, one of the Dutch submarines, which was known as O-21, you know, it's interesting. The United States was the only ones, I think, that really started naming submarines so early on.
Some of the British ones were named, but that came maybe a little bit later. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But anyway, O-21 actually, while conducting operations in the Mediterranean, sunk the Kriegsmarine U-boat U-95. And during this time period, submarine-to-submarine combat was, I would say, pretty rare, especially torpedo combat. That's what they describe here. Actually using torpedoes to sink an enemy submarine. That was something that would not be considered feasible up until much later in the 20th century. So hats off to O-21 for making a bit of military history. And I guess you could say you got to do what you got to do. As Will said, you weren't dealing with an extremely large force. And it's amazing. The Dutch government, I should say the Dutch civilian government, as opposed to the royal government, had a extreme pacifist approach before the Second World War. This might explain why they got rolled up in essentially a few days. But up until the Second World War, the military and the Navy, by extension, were extremely underfunded. And even with they had a few more ships that were actually under construction at the time, but they were captured by the Germans.
Yeah, and the De Ruyter, which was the flagship of the Dutch fleet in the East Indies, was really the only major unit they were able to build in the lead up to World War II. And even she was underfunded to the point where she had smaller guns and was of a smaller design than they wanted. But even with that, they were able to do some tremendous damage. What was interesting was in the immediate aftermath of the Pearl Harbor attack, the newly minted allied countries in the Pacific, being Australia, the United Kingdom, the Dutch, and the Americans, tried to kind of cobble together a fleet to defend Indonesia against the Japanese. And this was called the ABDA command, or I think American, British, Dutch, Australian, I think is what that stood for. And so basically, it might have been a different order, but what ended up happening was basically everybody contributed the ships that they had available. And although they did their best to try to hold off the Japanese, ultimately the big confrontation for this was the Battle of the Java Sea, where the Dutch fleet was led in the De Ruyter by Admiral Karl Dorman, and almost every Allied ship was sunk in that battle, or in the Battle of the Sunda Strait, which occurred immediately thereafter. A couple of them did escape, though. I think Wade's going to talk about that later, but that was a major early tragedy.
Yes. One of my favorite books actually talks about the hopelessness of the Battle of the Java Sea. And it's called Destroyermen by Taylor Anderson. Now, it creates a much bigger story, but the starting point is the Battle of the Java Sea and what they called Abda Float. That was the kind of code name you could say for this cobbling together of really, really old and obsolete ships. Heck, most of the American forces were combined, were of Wicks class destroyers, which we actually sold a lot of them to Britain actually during the interwar years. So these were also pretty underarmed ships. So ABDA, or the American, British, Dutch, Australian forces, were not in the best position to make a defense. And again, the underdog approach, USS Houston, put up an amazing fight. I'm trying to remember the Japanese ship she was up against, but Northampton.
I think it was four or five heavy cruisers, if I recall. Yeah. I have to look back. I think they were Nachi class heavy cruisers, but I'd have to check. But it was, you know, a long odds fight.
Absolutely. But anyway, getting back to that, just it's amazing to think that. Now, you mentioned that, of course, the Dutch had a bit of an advantage over the others, considering they actually had oil reserves. But that was not the case for some of the other countries that we qualify as these resistance navies. The French the French, for instance, I think they didn't really have any colonies that they could fall back on, and thence were kind of integrated into the British Royal Navy, as I recall.
So the French Navy's situation was super complicated because France. So, for example, we're going to talk about Poland in a bit. Poland never actually surrendered to the Germans, but France did, and so the French Navy was left in a weird. The French Navy was left in kind of a weird spot because the armistice basically stipulated that the French Navy couldn't go over to the British. And so, but it also stipulated that the French would hold on to their ships. And so it was this really uneasy arrangement. And of course, the British were really concerned that the French fleet was eventually going to be handed over to the Germans. And if that was the case, that would be really devastating for the British because the French had a very large, very modern, and very powerful fleet. It was not quite up to the same standards as the Royal Navy, but it was roughly equivalent to the Italian Navy. And it quickly got split up into several pieces. A few ships did, in fact, flee for England. I think a couple of the really old Corbet-class dreadnoughts did that, but they weren't of much use. But the most concerning force that the French had was their kind of elite fast strike unit, which they sent to Oran, Algeria. So the French had a lot of colonies in North Africa, but those were still fairly close to home. And so this force at Oran, Algeria, included two battle cruisers, the Dunkirk and the Strasbourg, two battleships, the Provence and the Breton. And then it also included several very powerful destroyers. The French had a group of destroyers called the Le Fantasque and the Mogador class destroyers, which were faster and more powerful than any other destroyer afloat. So this was a serious threat to the British. And so the British, this was one of the really tough and ugly early decisions that they had to make during the war. The Royal Navy issued an ultimatum to the French fleet. They gave them several options, one of which was to join the Royal Navy and carry on the fight against the Germans. Another one of which was to go to a neutral port and be demilitarized. And another, I think the third option was to go to another French colony, I think Mauritius, that was much more remote, might've been Martinique, that was more remote and demilitarized there. The fourth option was to be destroyed. And the French fleet ultimately chose none of the above, because they wanted to keep their ships. And Churchill ordered Force H, which at the time included the HMS Hood, the HMS, I think it was either the Resolution or the Royal Sovereign, and I think the Valiant, to open fire on the French fleet. And this was at the port of Mers El Kabir. And what ended up happening was the Provence was grounded, the Breton blew up, the Dunkirk was sunk, and the Strasbourg was the only French ship to escape. And so this had a couple of effects. It really turned French public opinion against the British because they were very upset that the British had killed over 1,000 French sailors in this attack, understandably. It also changed world public opinion about the British. This was still early on in the war, right after the fall of France, when people weren't sure if Britain was going to have the resolve to keep fighting. And so to many, this demonstrated that the British were going to do whatever they needed to do to defend themselves against the Germans. But the other side effect of this was that other French Navy ships that were in other ports that otherwise might have gone over to the British suddenly didn't want to. And an example of this was their newest and most powerful battleship, the Richelieu, which had just been completed and barely escaped France before it fell. And it went to the port of Dakar in Senegal in Northwest Africa. And the British sent, I think, three older battleships. I think they were Queen Elizabeth class ships, to Dakar to kind of apprehend the Richelieu and ask it to join the Allies. And the Richelieu ended up opening fire on and repelling the British fleet. And so the Richelieu stayed there for a while. And then the other remaining French battleship that was around in that period was the Lorraine, which was the sister ship to the Provence. And she ended up going to Alexandria, which was a British port where she was demilitarized for a bit. But what gradually happened over the course of the war was as the French fleet kind of stayed out there, public opinion began to turn back against the Germans. And ultimately, what was left of the French fleet in France ended up at the port of Toulon in the south of France. And the two major ships that were there were the Strasbourg, which had escaped Mers El Kabir, and the Provence, which had been repaired and sent there. And what the British and the French both feared finally came to pass, the Germans decided to try to seize the French fleet. And so the Germans show up in Toulon, and this is hilarious what happens. Oh, I forgot the Dunkirk was there as well. The French fleet, the guy in charge of the harbor invited the Germans in for desserts. And he kept the German commanders in his cottage having these desserts long enough for the crews of the French ships to scuttle their own ships in the harbor. And so by the time he finished, you know, pouring out the coffee and everything, the German dignitaries went outside to see the entire fleet sinking and on fire. And so the French thus denied their fleet to the Germans. And after this, the remaining French ships that were in other parts of the world joined the Allies. So the Richelieu joined the what was called the Free French Navy under Charles de Gaulle. She sailed to the United States. Three of the La Galissonnière class light cruisers, which were among the best in the world, also joined the Free French Navy. And then the Lorraine, which was over in Alexandria, also joined the Free French Navy. And so the Lorraine ended up supporting the Dragoon landings in the south of France. And the Richelieu served with the British Pacific Fleet in the Far East in 1944 and 1945. So ultimately, the French kind of took a while to come around to it. But in the end, what was left of their fleet ended up contributing very heavily to the Allied war effort.
Absolutely. And I think this just reinforces the objection that I raise constantly at family dinners and family events. The French don't surrender.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the French get a bad time for their one notable surrender instance, but a lot of their forces didn't. And a lot of people don't realize that a large portion of the forces that were involved in the D-Day landings and the subsequent liberation of France were French forces, many of which were actually drawn from the French North African colonies. It is a sad commentary on some of the prejudices of the period that the majority of the, or a large portion at least, of the French army that liberated Paris was actually soldiers from Chad, but they were not allowed to participate in the victory parade because they weren't, you know, ethnically French. So that was, you know, maybe not a great moment, but the French Empire and, you know, the French Navy did continue to fight for the Allies.
Absolutely. And we have a interesting more bits. Now, I mentioned the Dutch Navy early on. We'll be getting to my ship of the week later. But Will, I believe you have a pretty interesting ship going on in the Greek area of war.
Yeah. So my ship of the week is the Georgios Averof, which is a ship that you can visit today, which is pretty cool and fairly rare for the ones that we're talking about. And the Georgios Averof was actually the last armored cruiser commissioned in the world. And the armored cruiser was a type of warship that was popular around the world in the 1890s and early 1900s and going into the World War I period, and was kind of the predecessor to the heavy cruiser. It was generally considered to be made obsolete by the battle cruiser, but the concept kind of resurfaced as the heavy cruiser later on. And so the U.S. designation for a heavy cruiser was CA, which actually stands for cruiser armored. So that's where that came from. So anyway, the Georgios Averof was actually laid down originally as a Pisa-class armored cruiser for the Italian Navy. And then they decided that they couldn't pay for all three of them that they were trying to build. And so they offered the third one up for sale. And the Greek Navy, which was trying to build itself up at the time, decided to buy it, and the down payment was provided by a wealthy donor named Georgios Averof, and so they named the ship after him. And so it served in the Balkan War against the Turks. It was considered the most powerful warship in the Aegean in the time period. It also served in World War I and served in the Greco-Turkish War after World War I. So by the time World War II rolled around, she was already a veteran warship. She was commissioned into the Greek Navy in 1911. Her armament was 4 9.2-inch guns and 8 7.5-inch guns, and these were British-built weapons. So her armament actually differed slightly from her sisters in the Italian fleet. So anyway, she had already served with distinction throughout the war, and Greece came under attack by Italy in the beginning stages of World War I. And it actually started when a Greek light cruiser, the Elie, was torpedoed by an Italian submarine before the Italians actually declared war. And so this was considered a very dastardly action by the Italian fleet. Greece put up a much bigger fight than people remember. The Greeks actually managed to repel the Italian invasion and counterattacked, driving into Albania, which was Italian held at the time. And they were making such good progress that the Italians were forced to call on help from the Germans And so then the Germans and the Italians jointly counterattacked, and eventually Greece fell, but it took a very long time. And the Greeks did have some help from the British, but it wasn't enough. And so Greece also had two very obsolete battleships, the Kilkis and the Lemnos, which were pre-dreadnoughts that were originally the U.S. battleships Mississippi and Idaho, which had been sold to them, and the proceeds were used to fund the New Mexico-class dreadnought Idaho. These two ships were destroyed by air attack by the Germans, but the Georgias Averroth managed to escape. And so she went first to Alexandria, the same place where the Lorraine went. But unlike the Free French Navy or the French Navy, which was kind of waffling in what to do, the Georgias Averroth immediately offered its services to the Allies. And although her top speed at this point was only 12 knots, thus making her unsuitable for operations in the Mediterranean, she was the perfect choice for escorting convoys in the Indian Ocean. So that's what she did. And it turned out that although the 9.2-inch gun that she had as her main armament was no longer in service in the Royal Navy, the British did have a number of them in coastal defense installations, and so there were plenty of shells available. And the 7.5-inch guns that were her secondary armament were still in use on the British Hawkins-class heavy cruisers, so they had shells for those as well. So the Georgias Averroth served in with distinction in the Indian Ocean. She didn't actually participate in any battles. She was just escorting convoys. She did rescue sailors and soldiers from the Georgic, the White Star liner, which had a fire on board. And she did end up having a lot of mechanical issues. But her kind of crowning moment of achievement came in 1944 when Greece was liberated from the Axis. The Georgias Averroth carried the Greek government back into Athens during the liberation ceremony. So this was kind of her triumphant return to her homeland. During the war, she was known by the Greeks as Uncle George. That was her nickname. So that's kind of fun. And after the war, although she was considered highly obsolete by this point, they decided to keep her as a museum ship, and she is still available to visit. She's still actually a commissioned warship of the Greek Navy, and any Greek warship that sails into Piraeus, Athens, has to render honors to her. She was actually, this is very cool, there is a project underway right now to make her fully operational again. So she was restored to seaworthiness and towed to Thessalonica in 2017, where she had 130,000 visitors. And they're continuing to repair her engines to eventually make her fully able to steam under her own power, which is really cool. She is now the only remaining armored cruiser in the world. And I had the great privilege of being able to visit this ship in 2012. It was a very cool experience. The materials that they had on the brochures did kind of inflate her reputation a little bit. So as I mentioned, she is officially an armored cruiser. I believe the brochure referred to her as a glorious battleship, which is, you know, a little overblown, but that did show just how much she meant to the Greek Navy. And there is one other notable example of a resistance ship that you can visit today, and that's the Polish destroyer Błyskawica. I have no idea if I pronounced that correctly, which is currently a museum ship in Gdynia. And we'll talk a little bit about the Polish Navy later, but the Polish Navy fought with more honor and distinction than almost any other resistance navy during World War II. And it all started out with a really heroic and, I find, slightly tragic decision called the Peking Plan, where shortly before World War II started, the Polish government kind of saw the writing on the wall. They knew that something was coming. And the Polish Navy at the time included four modern destroyers. And they realized that these ships would get destroyed almost immediately by the German Navy when the Germans invaded Poland. So it was kind of useless to keep them around. But they thought that if they could escape to another country, they might be able to carry on the fight. And this was part of the Polish plan called the Romanian Bridgehead, which they were planning to retreat their armies into Romania and then resupply them via the Mediterranean using these destroyers. That didn't end up happening. But I think it was within a week before World War II started, three Polish destroyers, the Błyskawica, the Grom, and the Burza, sailed out to England, and they left one destroyer behind, the Wieczer, which ultimately went down defending Poland in the subsequent invasion. But those three ships served under the Royal Navy with distinction, but flying the Polish flag. I mentioned that Poland never surrendered, so they sailed as Polish ships for the duration of the war. I believe the Grom was sunk. I forget what happened to the Burza. But the Błyskawica survived. The Polish Navy also included several other destroyers that the British gave them over the course of the war, and the most famous example of which is the Piorun. And that has one did one of my favorite things that any Polish ship did. The Piorun participated in the hunt for the Bismarck, one of the most famous battles in naval history. And toward the end of that confrontation, a group of Polish and British destroyers led an attack on the Bismarck. And during this attack, the Piorun charged headlong at the Bismarck, a ship many times her size, transmitting on the radio, "I am a Pole." And she did survive the encounter. So anyway, lots of respect for both the Greek and the Polish navies. I highly recommend, if you ever get the chance to go to Greece or Poland, to visit the Georges Averof or the Wyzkowica.
Yeah, to be honest, the story about the about charging the Bismarck reminds me a lot of the Taffy 3 defense in the Pacific, but we'll get to that in a later episode. That will probably be an episode all by itself. But
the other thing to mention real quick too is that the Polish had really cool names for their ships. Błyskawica translates to lightning, and Grom translates to thunderclap, or thunderbolt, I think. So they picked very cool names for their ships.
Agreed. Agreed. If nothing else, they're intimidating. But
yeah,
to get to my ship of the week, we're heading back to the Dutch Navy. Now, as I mentioned before, the Dutch Navy was horribly underfunded, and also they were suffering from a government that was a pacifist movement at probably the worst possible time, being pinned right up against a Nazi Germany that seemed bent on expansion. You could argue that they had a similar issue as the British government under Neville Chamberlain, the idea of we should appease the Germans, we should make sure that they don't actually fight us. Yeah, that's not going to work for very long, or at least it proved to be that that wouldn't work for very long. But anyway, my ship of the week is an example of that. You could argue that this is a ship that represents what the Dutch were dealing with during their peacetime and interwar years that led to the Navy that they had at the outbreak of World War II. And this is his Netherlands Majesty's ship, Tromp. Now, this is not Trump, Tromp. Keep that in mind.
Distinction. Yeah. Yes.
With an O, not a U. But anyway, the Tromp was the lead ship of the Tromp class of destroyer leaders. Now, a destroyer leader is a bit of a strange category of ships. It's about the size of a post-World War II destroyer. So you're getting up into the 400-foot range plus. But generally, they carried about the same armament that you could expect on any destroyer. So they're not quite what a light cruiser is, but they're bigger than a destroyer. So this could very well say, hey, this is the biggest we can produce. At least that's what the government is allowing us to do. But anyway, the Tromp was completed and launched and commissioned between 1936 and 1938, so just before the dawn of the Second World War. So you could argue that she was the most modern ship that the Dutch had at the time. She carried 5.9-inch guns as her main armament, six of those, and she had an arrangement of machine guns and light guns, probably totaling about 20 altogether. And these would be increased as the aircraft threat became a more apparent threat, especially given her area of operation. And she also carried 21-inch torpedo tubes. And again, torpedoes will always be debated on whether they will be effective on a ship. Really, it depended on the torpedo that you were wielding. If you had a Japanese long lance, it was great. But if you had the torpedoes that the Americans were working with at the beginning of the war, whew, I don't know if you've heard how bad those were, Will, but you had, I think I've heard statistics, you had less than 10% chance of them actually working.
Yeah, most of them didn't even explode when they hit the target. It was bad.
Yes, yes. So anyway, like I said, upon her commission, Tromp was arguably the most powerful ship in the Dutch Navy. But of course, then the invasion of the Netherlands happens, and essentially you had the Dutch Navy scattered around the various Dutch colonies, and you also had them in their actual ports in the Netherlands. In the case of the Tromp, she was in Rotterdam, but managed to escape and fled through to the Mediterranean. And actually, she ended up running into a German passenger ship, the Orinoco, and actually got damaged by that. But she eventually made her way to the Mediterranean. And after that, she was sent to the Netherlands East Indies in August of 1939. And yeah, things went down from there. Now, she was spared the disaster of the Abdafloat operation. She was able to fight through that, and she was involved in 1942 in the Battle of the Badung Strait. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, but she was ended up very badly damaged by 11 5-inch shells from the Japanese destroyer Asashio. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Man, we're getting all the names that are confusing us today. But yeah. But anyway, the Tromp survived that fight, and she would go on to continue fighting in the Pacific, and eventually she was actually assigned to the US 7th Fleet in February of 1943. And again, when we're talking about the confusion that could happen with the French Navy and the British, this was the same thing with the Dutch. They had a similar thing, I should say, with the Dutch. They had most of their operation in the Pacific because obviously they couldn't operate anywhere near the their old territory in the Netherlands. So the Dutch East Indies, or at least areas around there, were their best bet. So especially once the United States started to operate its island hopping campaign, they really ended up operating under the U.S. fleet system more often than being independent operations, mostly because they just didn't have the, I guess you could say, the ship power to do so. But anyway, she also assisted the Australian 7th Division's landing on Balikpapan during operations to recapture Borneo from the Japanese. Now, this was late in the war, but anyway, she did end up assisting that, probably more in fire assistance more than actually fighting ships. But hey, any extra firepower is necessary when dealing with an island invasion, especially with an island as the size of Borneo. But anyway, after the war, Tromp was assigned to the British Pacific Fleet, again, getting sent around to different navies. And she was sent to Jakarta after that. And unfortunately, the Dutch were no longer welcome in the Dutch East Indies. They were Indonesia and Malaysia in particular declared their independence really quickly after the Second World War. So after that, Tromp's final duty, you could say, for the Second World War was to return Dutch prisoners of war that were held by the Japanese to the Netherlands, as they were celebrating with the New Amsterdam lighting the way into Rotterdam Harbor, if you remember that story from last time. But anyway, she would spend her final years as a training and accommodation ship before being scrapped in 1969. So unfortunately, the Tromp doesn't exist anymore, and the Dutch unfortunately do not have any examples that I could find of World War II fighting ships. So
there is one sort of exception. It's an odd one though. So Wade mentioned that the Dutch had several ships under construction before World War II. A couple of them were finished only after the war, one of which was the cruiser De Zeven Provinciën. She served in the Dutch Navy for many years before being sold to Peru as the BAP Almirante Grau. She was retired from the Peruvian Navy, wait for it, last year. where she had been the last serving gun cruiser in the world, and the Peruvians have announced that she is going to be preserved as a museum. So you do have a chance to see a Dutch cruiser if you go to Peru.
Interesting place to find a Dutch cruiser, I do have to say. But that's probably why I couldn't find any information on her, because she never technically sailed under the Dutch flag.
She did for a while, but you know, not under her current name. So yeah.
Right. So that was probably the issue. Just so you know, guys, we are omniscient on this matter. We are constantly learning more and more and more about maritime history. And that's part of what makes this interesting. We and Will correct each other. We learn from each other, and we want, and we hope that you can learn something through our learning process as well. So I can,
and please send us comments if you have anything to add to, you know, the new information that we've been talking about, or if you have any suggested topics or things you'd like to hear more about.
Absolutely. And I think on that note, It's going to be a fun time. Now, obviously, this is a bit of a special episode. We will be back to our regular programming very soon. But in any case, any final thoughts, Will, before we let the water back into the dry dock?
Just support your local museum ships if you have them. They can always use it.
Yes. And on a final thought for that, take a thought for the USS Texas. She needs... Yeah. A lot of help right now.
You know, I was just thinking about that because the Georges Averof is even older than the Texas. And so if we can make the Georges Averof seaworthy again, I think we can save the Texas. So,
yeah, especially given that the Greeks don't have a lot of money to begin with anyway.
Yeah, I'm impressed given the state of Greece's finances that they've managed to pull that off. So I think if they can do it, we can do it.
Absolutely. Go America and go Texas. But anyway, I can hear the water coming back into the dry dock now, and I think we can call this episode a wrap for today. Will, it's been an honor
sitting
with you again. Yes, thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you again very, very soon. Fair winds,
take care,
calm seas.